Welcome to Amateur Radio Topics. I'm Kevin, VK6 Lima Whiskey. And today I have my good friend with me, Steve, VE6 Whiskey Zulu. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Kevin. And it is morning, not for you. It is for me.
No, it's fairly late here. But, luckily, I'm still up and firing, so it's all good. So Steve is located, you're in Calgary, aren't you, Steve? You live in Calgary?
Physically located in Calgary, yes, in the city.
Yeah, okay. And Steve's got a remote station, which is how far away?
The station is almost exactly 100 kilometers to the north of me. Fortunately, good roads, good paved roads such that about an hour and 15 minutes, depending on how fast I drive, one way.
And how did you find this place? How did you find the remote location?
Well, I started by knowing I wanted to be on the top of a hill. And that's only because of my actual city location. I was very fortunate to be on quite a hill, a prominent high spot within the city. And I honestly was convinced that was giving me a bump on my ability, especially on the low bands. And so I found this remote location by very carefully studying topographic maps using Google Earth and whatnot to try and locate a high point somewhere within a radius. So that was it. I looked at a bunch of topo maps and tried to see where I could find that kind of place. And I was really, really fortunate to actually find this location, which is right on the very top of a prominent hill.
And the land was for sale.
That's the unbelievable thing, Kevin. Honestly, unbelievable.
Yeah, that's quite something. So how long ago was this? When did you start this project?
Oh, gosh, I'm not good with remembering exact dates. I'm thinking it's been, I'm feeling 2015 was when I found and closed the deal on the land.
Okay. Yeah. And I had a look at your video. Steve's got a really good YouTube channel, lots of very interesting stuff on the antennas, receive antennas, transmit antennas. And the video explains a little bit about how you went about setting up the station. And it very much looked to me as though you were really setting up everything. You had to put a road in, you had to put the power in, you had to have a building there, some sort of porter cabin for the shack. So there was nothing there at all on this hill?
No, there wasn't. It was completely undeveloped land. And in fact, I think that was, why it had sat on the market for a long time. No one had, in fact, they were, the owners were ready to take the sign down and give up trying to sell the land because of that. Exactly. It was just 10 acres. Well, I don't know what that is in hectares. I should know. But anyway, undeveloped land, just nothing but trees, 10 acres of trees. Fortunately, though, what I knew I required was internet. I needed to have an internet connection and I needed to have power. And it was clear by looking at it that, there would have been and was an ability to build an approach and a road to gain access to the top of the hill. And because it's such a prominent hill, there are actually four comm towers, one big microwave tower and a few other commercial communications towers, two of which house wireless internet. So, of course, that's the other thing I needed was internet. And so even though it was undeveloped, I had the two things I needed, which was power and internet.
Yeah, it's very good. And how long do you reckon it took you to set this whole thing up? Was it a year or two or...?
It went relatively quickly. I would say I was QRV within a year and a bit. We have the seasonality thing to deal with here in Canada with our frozen north.
yes.
I was very fortunate because in my prior life, I'm a geologist and have worked in the oil and gas business, exploring for oil. And at the time, I was still employed with the company. And part of our business is developing drilling locations, and that includes the need for a construction department, okay? And therefore, I had contacts, okay? I'm not saying I got a special deal, but what I did have was access to guys that knew exactly what I needed to do, and also were able to recommend good construction guys. And so basically I contacted an oil and gas lease development construction company. They basically took it from there. I basically surveyed where I wanted my road built and the trees that I wanted cleared. And they took it from there and did the rest. We harvested the trees and I had a dozer and a grader come in and clear the road. And so because of that, I just handed them the keys to build the access and clear the land. And so outside of waiting for weather, that process didn't take long. I mean, perhaps within a month I had, access. Power came in within a few months. We had overhead power brought in, and my the rest of it I did all on my own. I had no help. Most of the building was not hard. I had the trailer brought in, which houses my equipment, and once I had that, it was fairly straightforward to just start building things.
Yeah, that's good. That's a pretty quick turnaround. It's taken me longer than that to
check.
But there's been a few other things happening at the same time. Okay, so obviously I've had a look at your videos, and you've got a pretty good setup there with the antennas. So with the 160 millimeter antennas, you've got, is it what you've got, a two or is it a three element array with those verticals?
Well, Kevin, effectively it's a two-element array, a two-element parasitic array. Perhaps what drove me in that direction was my experience having built my own two-element Yagis. In particular, I, on 80 meters, use a two-element homebrew Yagi. And I do the same on 40 meters. I have a 40-meter two-element beam, which, again, I modeled myself and built. And through having come to understand how to tune and build and model two-element Yagis, I realized, well, heck, building a two-element 160-meter vertical array really is the same thing. And so I proceeded to model the antenna. Now, it's not unlike the K3LR design three-element array, which is very well described in John ON4UN's book. And I looked at that, and that three-element array is a really magical antenna in terms of really outstanding front to back. And I considered that, but the problem with the three-element array is it would have taken up a little bit too much space, especially from the standpoint of including the ground radial system for the two new elements.
Mm.
And so therefore, I thought, well, let's just stay with what I know within the space I have, which is the two-element. So I say it's a two element, but actually I have got two parasitic elements, but at any one time, only two of them are active. And the parasitic, any one active parasitic element will either be tuned as a reflector or a director. And that's how I get two directions out of the one parasitic element. And then the other element, when it's active, I do the same. So at any one time, it's a two element array. And the modeling would suggest I can achieve around 4 dB of gain over a single element. In other words, I'm not suggesting that's the absolute gain in dBi is actually higher than that. But if I compare in the modeling what my vertical standalone single element gives to the two element, I've got about 4 dB of gain, which that's like more than doubling your power. So.
Yeah, no, that's very good. So what height are these verticals?
The parasitic elements are made from irrigation tubing, and they're 75 feet high. How many meters is that? 20 meters, 21 meters? Sorry,
if I'm talking. Something like that. No, it's fine. Feet's okay for me. It's the rest of the audience sometimes. But sometimes I do feet and meters just to clarify things. But yeah, 75 feet, 21 meters, that's about right. Yep.
Yeah, but they're top loaded with some
top loaded.
50 feet of wire. The key with any vertical array though is the ground system, and that I certainly spent a lot of time installing the ground radial system, and that included having a skid steer or bobcat come in and clear the gravel off of the pad and where the verticals are located to allow me to add the new radial system, okay, to each parasitic, because that is important. That in many ways ended up being the most work is getting that all the copper on the ground.
So how many radials have you got down for each vertical?
Well, there are 100 radials. There's 100 radials on each of the parasitics, and they ultimately become integrated into with some bus systems into the ground radio system, which is already there or was already there for my main transmit and tower antenna.
That's pretty significant if you get into 100 radials. But you took away the topsoil to do that and then buried the radials and effectively refilled the land.
Well, I did in this instance, though I wouldn't, for example, here at my home QTH before I moved, I would just cut the grass very short and just lay them on top of the grass and they would become invisible in a matter of, a few months. But in this instance, because the area surrounding my installation, which is fenced in, it's covered with gravel. And so it was really necessary for me to remove.
Yeah. Is the ground conductivity fairly good up there, or is it just rock?
You know, Kevin, the truth is I don't know, but I suspect it is, because what I've noticed is it's a clay.
Clay helps. Clay helps. Clay is good.
I really
holds
think
the water.
So. Yeah, exactly. That's what I've noticed. I was going to say that what I found is when we have a lot of rain, and especially in the spring, runoff after the snow melts. Oh boy, it's very saturated. So I really, I think the answer
that helps.
Is, yeah, I think it's pretty darn good.
Definitely helps. I grew up in the UK, and I lived in a location, my parents' house, and they were on chalk. So the larger parts of the south coast of England is chalk, and it's obviously the worst case scenario if you're trying to set up an antenna system. But further, there's an area called the South Downs on the other side of the South Downs, which is a ridge of hills, all the way up the country, really past London. It's predominantly clay, and the difference between one side of the hill and the other, the people on the chalk and the people on the clay, it was night and day because the clay was so much better, particularly in the winter months, because their land would effectively flood in lots of places. But of course, it gave them a much better ground conductivity, whether they had verticals or horizontally polarized antennas or whatever, the clay was better. So if you've got some clay up there, that's good. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And so your transmit antenna, it does work very well. I don't think there's any doubt about that at all. You're from the area that you're in, and I know there's not an awful lot of guys around that area, but you are normally the best signal from the west coast of North America on any given time on 160 if the band's open. And of course, it's been in the doldrums a bit lately. And you've also got a pretty good shot on the polar path to Europe, but obviously that's not something you can take advantage of at the moment, not just because of the sun, but I guess because of the time of year, you wouldn't be getting that opening at all at the moment. But you've got a fabulous transmit signal, but obviously you need to be able to hear stuff as well. So I know you've got a very comprehensive receive antenna system there. And I know you've got beverages, and I'm pretty certain you've got a 9-circle array as well. And I think you've got beverage pairs. So how many receive antennas have you got in total? Because I think I've heard you mention this before. And I've got receive antennas here, but nothing quite on the scale of what you've got, I don't believe.
Yeah, I have a few. and I can explain why. I actually have a total of 15 beverage wires. A total, but they cover 9 directions, and I'll explain that in a moment, and also a 9-circle array. But can I add one thing and just sort of augment what you were saying about the transmit? Because in fact, it plays together, Kevin, with the receive side of it too. And that is, as I mentioned at the outset, or as we were discussing at the start, I really, really wanted to be on the top of a hill. And I personally am convinced that certainly the transmit array helps and the ground conductivity helps, just like we were talking about. But I am very confident that a big part of the propagation bump that I realize is because of being on the top of this hill. I mean, I'm from the top of this hill. It's like a 360 degree view all around, where I am at least 200 to 300 meters above the surrounding farmland. And again, I noticed I had a propagation bump from being on a hill here in the city, but I also noticed, and I, you know, you say I'm one of the better signals from North America. Well, I can tell you right now, N7UA, Bob, is now he's the king of the pile. And if you look at his location, he's also on a hill, except he's surrounded by salt water.
He's a good, yes, he's definitely a good signal. Obviously, it's slightly different propagation with Bob, because he's comes in a little bit later than you on that sunrise.
Yeah,
grey line. But yes, he's a good signal. No doubt. I don't know whether or not he's any better than you. It's hard. It's all a bit empirical, really, because, you know, obviously, if you're not in the same place on 160, you can get these peaks and troughs in the signal, and it's confusing as to who is the best signal. But he's obviously got a very good setup there. Yeah, definitely.
Oh, he does. And that's, I think, going, you know, side by side with Bob through into Europe on 80 meters and 160 meters, as well as on the Asian path, you know, that had a lot to reinforce my desire to end up on a hill. But I have done half to analysis, high frequency terrain analysis. You know, I've modeled my terrain by putting it into the program. Now, half to will not work on vertical antennas, but I there is some documentation in the ON4UN low band DXing book where he talks about vertical antennas on sloping terrain. And, you know, even if you just view it just in your mind, you know, If the ground is sloping down, you're naturally going to push your radiation angle lower. And I really think, Kevin, what's happening with me is, I mean, I am so high above the terrain that, I'm probably hearing extremely low angle signals that others, regardless of what kind of antennas they're using, just won't be able to hear. Or on the transmit side, be able to keep up. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that because I think that is a reality on both sides, both on the transmit and the receive side. So,
yeah, it would make a difference. I don't think there's any doubt. And is the location pretty quiet? I mean, if you got power line noise, have you got any other sort of noise that you have to deal with there?
Oh, yes, I do have noise that I have historically, okay, this is the key, had to deal with. So it's not a panacea in terms of, you know, there's just absolutely no noise and never has been. There have been a few power line issues, which I have resolved, okay, working with the power company. So, but having said that, once those noise issues have been resolved, predominantly power line noise, a few commercial sources, but I've been able to resolve those. And at that point, it is extremely quiet. I mean, I can hear people's horse fences ticking away that are like, you know, almost 2 kilometers away. So it's extremely, extremely quiet. Do you want me to talk about my receive antennas? Because
I'd like a rundown on those, because again, you've got the space and you've got the technical knowledge to have put this in place, but the theory behind them is interesting in terms of what you're doing, and also the diversity reception, that type of thing. It's not something that everybody can do, obviously, but it's something that people can maybe take something from and implement it in a different way at their own location. So yeah.
Oh gosh, absolutely. You know, you've hit on it all there, especially diversity receive. I'd like to talk about that because I think that's in some cases, if you have the capability to implement diversity receive, I think in many cases, that's one of the biggest misses that low band DXers just don't make the effort for when they should. To me, that's been one of the biggest game changers. But as far as the receive antennas go, I was very fortunate, even though I have 10 acres, my neighbor who owns the surrounding full quarter section of land, he was agreeable to allow me to spread the beverage wires out on his land, because sadly, or whatever you want to call it, beverage arrays especially, or even just single wires, take up a lot of space. The beauty of it, this land is all forested, and so therefore it's not it's not agricultural land. So my neighbor felt, well, you know, he didn't mind if there were wires running through the forest. So I began with single beverage wires, and I had all eight directions covered with them. And you know, they were very, very effective, and they really are, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to receive antennas, they are one of the simplest antennas to construct, and in many ways, one of the most effective ones. And they're really hard to mess up. Okay, I mean, you know, they're going to work for the most part. Of course, I was aware of something called the broadside phased pairs. I had played with on echelon staggered end fire arrays here in my city QTH in a green space, and they helped mostly to enhance the front to back because of the way the end fire array works. But yeah, having read a fair bit about the broadside pairs from others, not the least of which was Tom W8JI and others, it became clear that it was something I needed to try. Because the RDF of a broadside pair can be just spectacular. A broadside phased pair of beverages are basically two beverage wires that are spaced anywhere from 1/2 to 3/4 of a wavelength apart. So on 160 meters, that's about, 400 feet, 200 and something meters or whatever that is. So they're just two parallel wires, but they're 400 feet apart. So, you got 2,000 foot long wires that are spaced in, 400 feet apart. So a lot of real estate. But the two wires are just fed in phase. Okay, really simply, just two equal length pieces of coax and fed in phase back to the shack. They're easy to model, and I have modeled them, and you can easily see as you increase the spacing, the RDF, the received directivity factor, the pattern gets greatly enhanced for reducing noise from other directions. In other words, you enhance the forward lobe and diminish the rearward rejection and the side rejection as well, which translates directly into better copy. What goes with that, though, unfortunately or fortunately, the reason they become more sharp receiving antennas and better at reducing noise is because the forward beam width becomes more and more narrow. And you can very clearly see it when you model them, that the half power beam width becomes quite narrow. And so I had a very fascinating experience three winters ago now, where I had a beverage broadside pair to Europe at 45 degrees and a broadside pair directly north at 0 degrees. And what I found into Europe was, at times, even Northern Europe in Scandinavia and Sweden almost seemed to be better on my north pair than on the European pair. Of course, as soon as I plotted that up on a great circle map, it was clear that what I was getting was a dead spot between those two broadside pairs. And that's simply because the beam width was so narrow.
Yeah, you had a gap there. Yeah,
I had a gap. But the reason I'm talking about this is because if any of the listeners ever want to go down the road of a broadside pair, this would not be a problem if they were, and it was not a problem when I had just single wires, because the beam width is more narrow, right?
Yeah.
So what it pushed me to do was add another pair at 21 degrees between the traditional European pair and the North pair. And, well, I must say, it was remarkable. The following winter, I mean, that antenna just opened the world to, the Northern Europe. And not that I wasn't able to do it before, but, I was just losing. Well, I was losing about 4 dB.
Yeah.
So I've since added pairs to most directions, but there are still a few blank spots. But it turns out that I don't feel I need to add too many more since Europe is there's more concentration there. For yourself, you're on the direct west pair, and then I have another pair which is going southwest, which is my ZL pair. Okay, that's my new
unit. Yeah, because I mean, it's sometimes on 160. I mean, we've all noticed this, where you tend to get this skew path happening. A lot of the guys in North America report that I'm coming in, you know, from the JA direction rather than the heading they think I should be on. But obviously, you know, you've got enough antennas there to cover any skew paths or whatever. Yeah, with that path to Europe, that polar path, does that skew at all, or does it, is it fairly true to the Great Circle heading?
Oh no! On the contrary, it can skew dramatically, and it can skew dramatically. And I hesitate to say it, but I'm almost willing to say predictably it will skew, and it will skew in concert with increasing geomagnetic activity. And the what normally would be a direct path, say at 21 degrees, like, you know, really skirting the pole, it will just start to shift to the south. And I have seen a full 90 degree shift where I'm pointing east, okay, instead of 21 degrees northeast, to Europe. Also very common on 80 meters as well. Very common for me on the Asian path where the deep Southeast Asia, like Thailand and Burma and often even China, will not be on the direct northwest path for me, but it will be skewed west. In fact, when I worked the 8Q7, Kevin, we were both on the band when we worked the 8Q7 guy. And you know, his path, direct path, is right over the pole for me. And I mean, I was listening over top of you.
Yeah. So,
I mean, that's a 90 degree skew.
It's a big skew, yeah. And I think you were probably one of the few guys from North America from the West Coast of North America to work that 8Q7 on 160.
I got to tell you, Kevin, that's what makes
There was a few other guys trying in that subsequent, he was on for a period of time, you know, a couple of weeks there, but he wasn't on 160 all the time. And yeah, that opening that you have is probably one of the better openings. Although I did hear in one other occasion, I think. He had quite a few calling. K7ZV was calling him Rich, and I think Bob was on there as well. But I don't think they worked him. I think they had a few QRZs or whatever. He had a problem with his receive antenna, I believe. The receive antenna wasn't working, so he was having to use his transmit antenna for receive, the 8Q7.
So it wouldn't
have been ideal. In the tropics, it would probably be a nightmare, I should think. I mean, it's bad enough. If ever you have to go onto the transmit antenna off the beverages, you can hear stuff, but it's obviously hard work. And so it might explain why he wasn't able to work too many North Americans, not from the West Coast anyway.
Well, I got to tell you that working that guy was, you know, that's an example of what, you know, the thrill of the hobby and makes it all worthwhile. That was a super exciting QSO. Like I'm sure you're aware of it, but that part of the world from here is the whole.
It'd be very difficult. I mean, yeah,
it's a really, really tough path. It's, you know, in some ways it's a tough path, not because it's got a lot of distance, but it's because of the polar path. In some ways, you know, completely antipodal paths are actually easy. You know, you're going to get antipodal focusing, but so it's not a distance thing with him. It's more just the northern path for us. It's a shutout for us.
It's hard to do. It's a bit like us trying to work South America.
It's likely the same thing. Yeah.
It's the same thing. We've got to go over the South Pole and Phil, VK6GX, and Steve, VK6VZ, have spent years trying to work South America. I think Phil has managed it. I think he works in LDU or CE or something or other. And I think they've worked the odd PY. But season after season, trying to work these guys in South America during our winter time. So coming up now, there is a path there to South America on the grey line. And Phil will probably be, again, trying this year, I would say, to work South America. But I've never even heard of South American on 160. Now to go on 80 metres, you get one. But it's hard work even working them on 40 metres from VK6. The path is so polar that there's so much absorption of the signal. It's just very difficult. And again, you know, that's sometimes where a skew path will help you. It's actually easy to work them on the high bands and 40 for that matter on the long path. So you beam over the North Pole and you work them on the long path.
Yeah, basically, Kevin, you're describing exactly our Zone 22 reality, you know.
That's
India,
right. It's the same thing.
The exactly. And it's the same. Yeah, I worked India many times on 40 meters, and I've also worked them on 80 meters, which was another thrilling QSO. But more often than not, it's not polar. It's the long path, either out across the Pacific Ocean or directly almost a southern polar path. So it's really strange.
Yeah. So, but I believe you've also got a nine circular, is that right?
I do, you know, and that was always part of the plan. Again, mostly because I want the ability to use diversity receive, and of course we'll get to that. So yes, I wanted a second receive antenna system. You know, rather than just, you know, I could still use diversity with different beverages, but there's a benefit to having a different type of antenna. So I ended up choosing the nine circle array, which I came to become aware of originally since DX Engineering was in the past selling them. They don't sell them anymore, but they marketed this antenna called the nine circle through the YCCC club, that Yankee Contest Clipper Club. They built this array, they being the club, through the work that John W1FV did, and he published the information on this array in the National Contest Journal. And they decided to make kits, okay, to build this array, and DX Engineering sold them. So that's what initially moved me to go in that direction, mostly because they're relatively affordable compared to the eight circle array, which is developed by Lee, TJR, I think. So I purchased this array and built it, and was very happy with how it was performing. By the way, the array is very simple. We call it a nine circle, but really it's just one central vertical surrounded by eight other verticals. They're high impedance verticals, meaning that they're fed just against a ground rod. There's no ground radio systems, fed at the high impedance point with a high impedance amplifier. All right. Yeah. But really, at any one time, there's only three of the elements that are active. And it's acting basically like a three element end fire array. And they're just phased.
Yeah.
And they're just phased. And then, of course, in the center is a switching matrix, which just rotates either the direction on the active three at any one time, or we'll select another three and have two directions with that. Okay, it's pretty easy to imagine how that works.
How does that compare with the beverages? How do you find in real life? How does that compare with a long beverage or a beverage pair for that matter?
Well, I must confess. Obviously, like any antenna, there are times when they will sort of trade places, okay? But on balance, I would say that the nine circle can't quite keep up with the beverage pairs, okay? And nor should it in modeling. But in actual practice, more often than not, the pairs will eclipse its ability to hear. Comparing to a single beverage wire, more often than not, they are the same. Again, depending on, you know, the wave angle and whatnot. And that actually turns out to be consistent with the modeling, or, you know, agrees with the modeling, because the RDF of the nine circle, you know, computes to be in and around 12 dBi or 12 dB, not DBI, 12 dB of RDF.
Yeah.
And as does a single vertical, rather a single beverage at about 1,000 feet long. So, you know, that's why it's a heck of an option for people with limited space, because the nine circle, I forgot to mention, but my array is a 120 foot diameter circle. Okay. The elements are 60 feet apart, right? So it's a 60 foot radius circle. So in 60 foot radius circle, it's like having 8,000 foot long beverages.
For a lot of people, that might be the only space I've got available to fit that in. I could probably fit one in here. I mean, I've got 2.5 acres, which is not quite 10 acres, and I've got beverages because, as you pointed out, there's very little to go wrong with a beverage. You put them up and they work. I've never even considered a nine circle array. But that's doable for a lot of people in a lot of locations.
One thing I would say is another direction I went was to make modifications to the array. And I've communicated quite a bit with John, W1FV, and I have actually redesigned the combiner board with KiCad, the combiner PCB board, as well as the high impedance amplifiers. Though I don't market them, I've made my PCB KiCad files available. I've got YouTube videos on all of the information about how to build one. The boards that I have designed, the PI4, Charlie Group. Google them. They actually sell my PCB boards, including my very latest design, which uses SMD common mode chokes on the board. I've had a lot of positive feedback from the community at large that have built these arrays using my boards as well as the PI4CC guys' boards. And I think it's generally available to a lot of people. And I think, as you say, a great option for it would be tight in a small backyard, but if you've got a large enough garden and a large enough room, it's definitely an option.
Yeah, what are the height, the verticals on the nine circle? What height are they?
They're 20 something feet, 6 meters okay. or so.
Yeah. So that's all very achievable actually in terms of 160. Can you also use it on 80, or do you need a completely separate model?
No. That's one of the benefits of the array. In fact, I've just recently been doing a lot of modeling with it for that reason, mostly going the other direction down the broadcast band, because I do some BCB medium wave DXing as well. But it's designed such that it's quite broadbanded, and yes, it maintains a very reasonable front to back and RDF on 80 meters. It is workable on 40 meters. It's got reasonable front to back. The RDF gets a little diminished on 40 meters. The spacing is just a bit too much for that band. So, but yes, it's multi-band.
Yeah, that's very good. Very good. So with your remote setup, you're using Flex, a Flex transceiver, aren't you? Is it a 6400 or something? Or what have you got there?
I'm using the 6600.
Well, the 66, okay.
Mostly because compared to the 6400, it has the second DMU or whatever they call it, the spectral unit, so that I can have two slices, and I need that for diversity, right? So 6400 doesn't have that. Yeah, it's the 6600 that I use predominantly, though I do have also the K3, and I can toggle between either of those radios as I will.
Yeah. So with the diversity, you'd normally be with either the Flex or maybe the K3, you could be listening on the beverage pair and the nine circle, one in each ear, or whatever the case may be.
Yes. Both radios have the ability for diversity receive. Originally, the K3 was one of the few radios with the main and the sub receiver that were phase locked and really had the ability to effectively use diversity, and that was the radio I always used. Fortunately, the Flex, with the two built-in radios or the two slices, it also is phase locked. And so, yes, what I do always, and that's important, always 100% of the time, I have in my left ear the beverages, and in my right ear I have the nine circle. And so I can, change directions on either of them. Obviously, select whichever beverage I want and whichever the nine circle direction I want in my other ear. So the normally working DX, like yourself, they're usually both listening to you on the same direction, though it's handy at times. For example, if there's a skew path, I can maybe have the beverages on the west pair, and then maybe if you're skewing north, I can put the nine circle the other direction. The key with diversity, and if any of the listeners have never tried it, it is a difficult thing to explain. Often diversity receive we call it the true definition is stereo diversity. Okay, it's stereo because you're using stereo headphones where one on the beverages in one ear and one receiver on the nine circles in the other ear. I'm repeating myself, I know, but there's a difference between you know, it properly, it should be called stereo diversity.
Yeah, no, I agree. I can do the same on the 7610. It's got the two receivers. You can track it. You can put, you know, you can sync it up. And, yeah, and so it's a very useful feature.
The magic, though, often diversity people feel or just discuss how, you know, you get broad fading. Okay, the one say the beverages are fading down, and yet the nine circle is fading up, and indeed that happens. You know, over an extended period, you know, you can hear them. You know, the waves. It literally, you can, when you're listening to it, it goes between your ears. It's like it's moving in your head, right?
Yeah.
The one's coming up. However, and I think this is the point I wanted to make is that's only one thing. What I have found, and I cannot describe it, and unless you've used it, it's hard to understand. But even beyond the long-term fading, even copying CW, there is some sort of a magic where even, you know, if you're hearing a dash within a letter, somehow by having both, the dash gets completed. This is very difficult for me to explain, but you just end up with better copy.
I've experienced that. I understand exactly what you mean. There's an effect that occurs almost between your ears or within your head, that the CW becomes a little bit more. It can be easy to read, and I think it's less tiring as well sometimes, particularly if you're concentrating for long periods of time. If you've got the diversity reception in there, it's a fuller sound. So
it's absolutely, it's a different sound. It's fuller. It's almost, I'll describe it as hollow, but yeah. Which sounds not full, but it is. And yeah, I always find it difficult to explain, but I honestly am convinced that it's made the difference for many, many DX contacts, which I would not, like the AQ7, I don't think I could have heard them without diversity. You know, the times we know when I could hear them coming back, I probably wouldn't have got it, because just the one, maybe the nine circle, just helped fill in that dash when, you know, I was copying my call, right? Anyway, of course, one last thing, which is another huge benefit if you're a contester with diversity, and this I've experienced many times. If I'm working Europe on 160 meters during the Stu Perry, for example, well, if I have all my ears on Europe, I mean, my antennas are very directive. And if the Southwest US is calling me, or Texas is calling me, I will not hear them. I mean, my antennas are extremely directive.
No, I've tried to work you off the back of your antennas. I know what you mean.
I'm never ever going to hear you. And so, I'll add to that. That's often why people go, you know, there'll be comments. Well, you know, the guy's deaf, right? Well, you know, he's probably not deaf. He's just not listening. And I've heard that with the guys in the East Coast, right? They're working Europe, and you know, their arrays are not pointed at me, and they're loud, right? But yeah, they can't hear me. So of course, obviously, I'll have the beverages on Europe, and then I can be toggling in my left ear the nine circle, you know, to the Southwest, and listening for domestic callers off the back. So, you know, huge benefit for
a that does make a difference. I mean, I'm interested in contests that most of my contests revolve around the HF bands, and the lower bands are there to harvest multipliers and whatever. But the thing with the diversity reception in a contest is, and the thing that I've noticed is that on the second radio, I can be listening on the, if I'm on the HF bands, I can be listening on the main beam antenna, and on the second receiver, I can be listening on a receive antenna, which is away from the main transmit antennas. And what I find is with the diversity reception on the second receiver, if I open up the pass band, the pass band and the shift control on the second receiver, and get a slightly different aspect to the signal, that helps as well. Rather than have both radios on 300 hertz, you know, whatever, I'll open the second one up to 500 hertz and shift the passband, shift the twin passband that the RC7610 has got. It's quite a nice feature there. And I'll shift it off by 50 hertz, 75 hertz, 100 hertz, so I get a different characteristic in the other ear. And that actually helps quite a lot with pileups, where you get everybody calling on the same frequency because they've spotted you on, you know, a certain frequency, and everybody just jumps on there and nobody tries to offset anything. And so that twin pass band with an offset and an opening up of the pass band on the second receiver makes a big difference to how the pileup then sounds. All of a sudden, the signals, they sort themselves out a bit. And it's actually less tiring running a pileup like that. If you run a pileup hour after hour, it's a better way to do it, I think. So there's a lot of things about diversity that these modern radios are opening up. I mean, obviously, you know, you've got it with the K3, you've got it with the Flex, I've got it with the 7610. But you've got to have a second receiver, second antenna that makes some sense. And I've got receive antennas set up for the HF bands as well as my LF antennas. And they're as far away from the transmit antennas as I can get them. So that helps me with the single operator two radio and interleave QSOs and all that sort of stuff. And I've got two IC7610, so I'm genuinely running single operator two radio. I believe with the Flex, with the 6600, you've got two radios in the box, which is probably a slightly better setup. But of course, I think there's a little bit more computing power required than the 7610s. So it's six and one half as the other, you know. It's the diversity thing's an interesting thing. Steve also, 6VZ, has done quite a bit of experimentation with the diversity side of things. He really quite likes it as well. So he refers to it as being a binaural type experience for him. So yes. Whether or not that's right or stereo or whatever, but it's you've definitely got to listen to it with stereo headphones. I know there's guys doing this with mono headphones or mono connection because it's not the same effect at all.
No, it's not the same effect at all. No.
Yeah, it's very good, Steve. All very very interesting stuff. So 160 is in the doldrums at the moment, I'm afraid.
My goodness. This is perhaps one of the most dramatic shutdowns I've experienced in a while. I mean, of course, we're expecting it, right? We're really rocketing up out of the...
Oh, yeah, solar activity has gone crazy. Yeah.
But talk about slam shut. My goodness, it just shut down on us.
Yeah. Yeah, this season's not been too bad. I've not been on for the whole season because I had a bit of a disruption here with the building works, and I'm still my shack is still set up in the laundry. I'm still building the shack. We've had quite a bit of actually be more on top of this stuff now I'm retired. But actually, we've been busy. I seem to have been busier since we've been retired than I was when I was working, and which is a bit of a concern. But certainly 160, yeah, I'd say it's gone from. I can remember 2 or 3 months ago that we had some fairly good openings to North America, some very good openings. One particular one where I worked, Steve, AA6AA, and you know, he was 15, 20 dBs overnight. It's an unbelievable signal. And then since then, there's been virtually nothing. It's been really difficult. And I know we're coming into the time of year where it's not going to be great anyway for North America with the noise levels and whatever, but... let's see how it goes. I mean, the solar activity is probably increasing at a rate faster than anybody predicted. All the predictions were for a pretty slow upswing and a low peak. And I think that might be completely different now.
Yeah, it looks like it's really rocketing up. You know, when I speak of conditions, okay, now don't... don't take offense, Kevin, because we all love you guys down under. And, but I must confess, I've been finding it difficult to drag myself out of bed in the morning and work the VKZLs. But I think, you know, that path for us is relatively reliable. The shutdown really that I'm referring to is Europe. For us from here on the West Coast, that's the challenge, is, you know, the polar path, as you know, and that's where it just shut right down. I don't know what my total is so far this season, but I think I'm up to 500 or 600 QSOs with Europe. But that was up until, you know, 2 months ago. And then the lights went out, and there was just, you know, most nights I'd be working 5 or 6 or maybe 20 or 30 Europeans a night, over the pole. And then it just shut down.
I was on the other night. I think the A index was 38 or something, and I was trying to work Bob W7RH. I think I worked him in the end, but really, it's crazy. The polar map and the solar wind is elevated. So yeah, let's see how things go. But we may be in for a period now of reduced 160 meter conditions, and I think. Obviously, it helps when the sun is quiet. But there we are. We have to go. We need to go through this cycle. I mean, I quite enjoy it because I like the HF bands as well. I've been enjoying that, and I'm looking forward to the next contest because of that. Because in VK6, if you get at least some, if we get some sunspots and we get an enhanced flux number, everything becomes a lot easier from VK6. It's probably one of the remotest cities in the world. And without sunspots, it's even more remote. So, yeah, it's fun from a HF contesting perspective, for sure.
Well, I think that's great to hear, Kevin, because, gosh, you know, I've been migrating a little bit higher in the bands. Normally, I find if I'm above 40 meters, I'm gasping for air. It's so high. but I understand what you're saying, because, gosh, if you're stuck on 160 meters, like you say, we just have to wait. Well, you have to wait 10 years, Kevin. So it's good to know you've got some options here.
So it's all good. I mean, I've been playing around a bit on HF actually with some different antenna designs, just testing them out. And the way I test them out is to go on and run QRP. So I'll go on there and see if I can work, you know, if I've built a particular antenna for the HF band. So I've got another one that I'm messing around with at the moment. And I go on and see if I can work you with 5 watts. And if I can work them with 5 watts, then I'll see if I can work them with 1 watt. And it's amazing how many stations I've worked in Europe with 1 watt on 20 meters. And also on 10 meters, I've worked some stuff on 10 meters with one watt output. And it's, you know, it's a fair distance from here to Europe. So that's a little bit of fun. It's a good way to test the antenna out. If I can work it into Europe with QRP, then I know the antenna is pretty well working. Because obviously, if I fire up the linear or whatever, you're going to work them anyway. So,
oh, I tell you, it's Kevin. It's the magic of radio. I mean, come on. I really and truly. I mean, the hobby for me, I was lit up by this hobby as a young lad. But the magic still, is with me from the standpoint of, you know, you're down to 1 watt, and you're exciting this little piece of aluminum. And somehow that electromagnetic disturbance is vibrating up to the other side of the planet to some guy's piece of aluminum, and he's hearing you. I mean,
it's unbelievable.
I don't know.
Yeah.
If you just stop and think about it, it's magical.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool. So that's been a bit of fun. And there's one other thing I wanted to ask you before we finish up as well, because obviously this whole station's remote, and you've got it fairly fine-tuned there. You can operate from just about anywhere on the planet and activate your remote station. Do you have anything in place for, say there's a huge lightning storm that comes through or whatever, have you got anything in place remotely to disconnect everything?
Well, yeah, I can answer that fairly well. The short answer is no. Everything remains live. But first of all, I'm not going to say it'll never be a problem. So far, I've been lucky, and there have been a number of many lightning storms every summer. I have taken some hits. Nothing in the shack has been damaged. The beauty of having designed this from the ground up is all radio equipment is housed in my metal box, the trailer. Okay, it's an office or oil field or work personnel trailer. Yeah. The entry panel is a solid copper plate. Every single wire, be it a control line or coax, is protected either with MOV or gas discharge tubes. I have a whole house lightning arrestor on the power supply coming into the house. Okay, on the main, you know, the main power line into the distribution panel.
Yeah.
So I think that unlike maybe a home installation, I designed this. You know, really with a focus on, you know, minimizing and maximizing my lightning, you know, deterrence. So far, I have not had a problem. Okay, now of course that means this summer I will, but I have had a few hits. I've lost a number of beverage boxes in the field, some of my switch boxes. I lost all of the snubber diodes on every relay in my nine circle array because I took a hit. In fact, I can see the scorch mark on the top of my 75 foot parasitic array. I can see the black mark where the lightning hit.
Yeah, because you're 200 meters up there above the surrounding land. You're a target, you know, for sure.
I am. Fortunately, I have, you know, a 500 foot microwave tower near me, but, you know, hopefully it'll go there before me. But yeah, but I've also included, you know, a lot of, you know, it's been evolving, Kevin. I'm adding gas discharge tubes across many of my beverage lines, you know, in case I take a ground impulse that it'll, you know, dissipate that. So, yeah, you know, damage will happen sometimes in the with receive antennas. But by and large, no, I've been fortunate.
Yeah. Okay. That's really good. Well, look, Steve, that's really good. I really appreciate you coming onto the podcast and having a chat about the setup you've got there. It's quite unique, I think, in terms of the effort you've put in and the results that you get. It's just amazing. So we look forward to having some more QSOs on 160 in due course.
Well,
when the band opens up again.
Well, you bet. Well, I'm sure we could have worked this morning, Kevin. I just, I think we missed each other. The VK9NT, I don't know if you noticed, my RBN skimmer was spotting
him. Yes, I saw that, yeah.
Quite a bit.
There was 80 wasn't too bad, and I did work a few guys on 80. I worked VK9NT on 160 and 80 this evening. And he wasn't a particularly good signal with me. But I worked him first call. It's not that far from here to Norfolk Island. Actually, it's probably about 4,000 kilometres. But if we work a ZL from VK6, it's more than 5,000 kilometres. And we consider those to be locals.
Right.
But it appears that VK9NT had a pretty good signal into North America on 80 and 160. So it's just the way conditions are at the moment. The band looked pretty flat. I didn't hear anybody. I didn't hear any other North Americans. I did CQ quite a bit, and nothing really happened on the RBN or the spotting network. So it's hard to tell whether or not there was really much of an opening there. There was an opening about a week ago. I think you picked me up on a few spots when I was calling CQ. And again, nothing much was around. You know, I didn't really work anybody. So I think the level of activity on 160 has also dropped with the downturn in conditions as well, to be honest. I'd say on the ATF bands, the activity's really been quite good on CW. I wouldn't say it's extraordinary, but if I get onto 40 meters or 10 or 15 meters and call CQ, there's normally a bit of a queue there waiting. So I think we just have to accept the fact that coming into the summer months in North America, the conditions are such that the activity always drops off a bit anyway.
Yes.
And a lot of guys take, you know, they take their 160 meter antennas down, they take their beverages out of the farmers' fields and do all that sort of stuff, and nothing really happens again until October.
That's absolutely true, and I don't do that. So look, I'm going to try.
Yeah, try and stay on. Try and get up.
I'm going to try and get myself to the radio. No, I do. I mean, last summer I was active all the way through.
Yeah, I remember.
The summer.
Yeah, I think I
endeavor to do that.
I think last year you worked Phil VK6GX on the June the 21st or something, summer solstice QSO. On 160, pretty certain. I think I'm pretty certain you worked him right on the. Well, for us, the shortest day. For you, the longest day, perhaps.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the shortest day, and that's a challenge because you know our days. You know, just so you know, we're at 51 degrees north, and you know I can be out mowing my lawn at, you know, 10:30 p.m.
Oh yeah, yeah. We've done enough trips to Europe during the summer to really enjoy that aspect of life. I quite like that side of things. We don't really get that here. We have no daylight saving here in VK6, and we don't get those extremes. We don't get the extreme of summer and winter conditions in terms of the sunrise sunset period, unlike, say, you know, Scandinavia. We've been up to Norway and Finland and And yes, it's 24-hour daylight. It's crazy.
Yeah. So I got to get up early to. I got to get up early. By the way, I looked, checked my log. Yes, indeed. I worked Phil on June 18th in 2020.
18th. Okay. Yeah, just about. Okay. Yeah, he mentioned it to me. He made a point of telling me. Because Phil doesn't live far from here. He lives in another suburb, which is about maybe 10 or 15 kilometers from here as the crow flies. And Steve, VK6VZ, lives only probably 3 or 4 kilometers from me, but fortunately on the other side of the hill. So it helps to mask his signal a bit. They're both pretty keen 160 meter guys. Steve's gone off on a bit of a tangent lately. He's not on 160 quite as much as he used to be, but Phil is very enthusiastic. He's spent a lot of time actually on his beverages. And I think he may have some beverage pairs up there. I think he's got 25 acres of land up there at Gidgegenna. So he's got the capacity to do that. So, it's all good anyway. Well, look, Steve, thanks for that. I really appreciate it. And we'll draw this to a close. And we'll be in touch.
Well, you bet, Ken. By the way, I checked my log. We've got 125 QSOs on 160 meters. I just pulled you up cool. in my log. Yeah. So we've had a few QSOs, and let's shoot for more. Well, you know, Kevin, I've enjoyed this. And hey, look, you know, if you want to have a chat again, we can talk about some other things another time. I enjoyed the chat a lot.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's very good. When I wrap this all up, I'll do a bit of an intro and then I'll do an outro, and I'll give your YouTube channel a bit more of a plug on that, because that's a very good site. I went on and had a quick look this evening before we chatted, and I hadn't been on there for a while, and I was surprised how much more information you had available. So well done. It's excellent. Very good.
All right. Well, thanks for inviting me. And I think it's a great thing you're doing, and I'm looking forward to listening to more of yours. I've listened to a number of yours, but I should get back and see which ones I haven't heard yet.
Yeah, there's a few on there. Steve and I have done a few together. They've worked quite well, and we did some for the Commonwealth contest, the Baru contest, which was held back in March. So the organisers of that, Steve and I did a podcast anyway. We sent it off to them and said, we really like this. Can you also do a podcast when we finish the contest, do like a post-contest podcast? So I said to Steve, okay, well, we can do that. That's fine. And then we got that one done. And they said, well, look, actually, we really like that as well. Can you now do one and incorporate people that have traveled to these out-the-way places like Cayman Islands and the Gambia and Gozo and whatever during the contest? And I said, well, we can do. I said, but I really need some audio from these guys. So they pre-recorded some audio, sent it across to me, I wrapped it up in an episode and published that one as well. So there's three episodes on the Commonwealth contest, and I know that's not necessarily something that you take part in, but the episode with the travellers is quite interesting. Travellers Tales, it's called.
Okay, I don't think I've heard that one.
Yeah, there's Colin G3CWH goes down to Cayman, and he's quite funny actually. It's funnier probably about the travel experience he has than the radio experience. And Don G3XTT goes to the Gambia in West Africa. And that was an interesting... And these excerpts are just sort of, 7 or 8 minutes long. It's not a huge podcast. Mike G3VYR went to Gozo near Malta. And he had an interesting trip. He drove out in a camper van and went out to Gozo and set up field day style and did the 24-hour contest. So I quite enjoy doing the podcast, but when I was working, there wasn't quite as much time to devote to it. Whereas now I'm finding, well, it's pretty easy just to fit a podcast in, and particularly if it's just myself. Obviously, if somebody else is on the podcast, inevitably it's going to run on a bit longer. But it's a bit of fun. It puts a little bit back into the hobby, and some of the stuff that I've been doing with the antennas is more aimed probably at people with. Maybe not 10 acres or 2.5 acres of land. It's aimed at people with maybe smaller gardens or plots or blocks or whatever you like to call it, and they're trying to make the best of what they've got. So some of the antennas that I've worked on here for my receive antennas for the HF bands for the contesting have ended up being quite good transmit antennas as well for somebody with a small lot. So some of those episodes I've published, and they've had some pretty good numbers actually. So yeah, there we are. All right. Well, look, you have a good day. I'm going to go and probably hit the sack now, and we'll catch up again soon. 73s.
Well, yeah, you bet, Kevin. Sounds great. Well, you know, you you have a good sleep well. And actually, what I'm going to do is get my boots on and shovel the driveway because we had a snowstorm last night. So that's my task for the morning. So anyway, it was a real pleasure, Kevin. And we definitely will be in touch. We'll be talking.
Yeah. Thanks again, Steve. Appreciate it. Cheers.
You bet. 73.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Just like to thank Steve, VE6WZ, for taking part in this podcast this evening. Steve's got a great YouTube channel. Just look for VE6WZ on YouTube. You'll find transmit antennas, receive antennas, construction projects. It's a really great resource. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, you can contact me on vk6lw.kev@gmail.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, if you like these podcasts, maybe share them with your friends or share them with the local radio club. That really helps me, helps with the rankings, and ultimately helps more people find these podcasts. 73s for now from Kevin, VK6 Lima Whiskey.